Hello, my name is Christy Kalavig, host of Vital Connections On Air. Over the next few months, we will be using our episodes to explore rural-urban issues. Some episodes will discuss areas that we differ, but more will show ways that we are similar, and all of the episodes have been created with the hope of starting a larger conversation. We hope that you enjoy them. Welcome to Vital Connections On Air, a podcast brought to you by University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality that explores the trends and topics important to communities and leaders throughout Minnesota. My name is Christy Kalavig, and I'm an Extension Educator with the Center for Community Vitality. And today I am joined by Kelly Ash, Research Associate with the Center for Rural Policy Development. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm really happy to have you join us today as we continue talking about rural-urban issues and how they are connected and similar, yet different and unique. And today, you and I are going to chat a little bit about workforce. Before we dive into that, I guess, let's back up a little bit and tell me a little bit about your role as a research associate for the Center for Rural Policy Development and really what the center does.
Yeah, so the Center for Rural Policy and Development was actually created by the state legislature here in Minnesota, probably, I think it was in the late 90s. At the time, legislators were talking about policies during legislative session. And when they're talking about these policies, they would have committee hearings and folks come in and other organizations come in to talk about the impacts these policies might have on their regions. And they, at the time, heard a lot of metropolitan-based organizations that had a lot of data on hand to talk about the impacts of policies. And they were making comments, legislators would make comments that they would hear only anecdotes from their rural areas and just couldn't find as much data and didn't have maybe the organizations to present that data specifically through a rural lens as well as metropolitan organizations did. So they created the Center for Rural Policy and Development to kind of help fill that gap. And our work really is around gathering information and conducting research on topics and issues related to rural Minnesota. And by rural, you know, that's that kind of vague word that a lot of people throw around with no real true meaning. And Center for Rural Policy honestly isn't that much different. We consider it to be pretty broad. Really, we just focus on anything outside of the seven county metro. And we try to do a really interesting job whenever talking about our research or presenting information to, you know, try to provide that that spectrum of urban and rural. You know, you have things that are very rural and you have things that are very urban in Minnesota, but most of Minnesota exists somewhere in between. And so we try to make that clear whenever we're doing our research and presenting information to try and give a full view of the different ways in which a policy or an issue is impacting, let's say, Hancock, Minnesota, town of 800 versus Alexandria, Minnesota, town of 15,000, because there are differences there too, and there's a lot of nuance.
How do you get the ideas for the research that you do, and what are the current topics that you're looking at?
So yeah, you know, we send out a thought leader survey every year with a list of 15 to 20 different issues we as staff members have heard about or are concerned about. And then folks rank that, and that survey goes to every state legislator in Minnesota and also every Minnesota newspaper publisher and editor across Minnesota, because those guys really have the eyes and ears on the ground in rural areas. And then other various leaders across Minnesota, and they rank the issues as, you know, is it important and urgent, or is it just important but not urgent, and is it neither? And then we kind of figure out what are the top 4 to 6 topics, and that's what we work on every year. Right now, we're taking a look at the ag economy. You know, that's a big topic of a discussion, and what kind of impact that's having on a more local rural economy level. Okay. I am currently deep into healthcare access issues for rural areas. And then we're also taking a look at the balancing of childcare regulations and business needs. We're doing a survey out to county administrators looking at what are the impacts on addiction. You probably read some things, you know, the opioid epidemic, obviously, but also meth is making a really strong comeback, particularly in northern Minnesota. And so we're taking a look at, you know, how counties are handling that. And then one of the interesting things I'm going to be doing right after healthcare is looking at the differences in wages and cost of living across Minnesota. You know, you always hear these things about people saying, well, yeah, you get paid less in rural areas, but it costs less to live there. We're going to kind of dig in to see if that's true or not, kind of bust through some of that language and kind of see what the truth is there. So, yeah, that's what's on tap.
So the work that you did around workforce this year, and you've released a report that shares your findings, and we'll make sure that we link that here on our podcast page. But that must have been one of those topics that kind of rose to the top in your 2019 survey.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this had a lot to do with, you know, job vacancies was just turning out to be a pretty big deal throughout the legislature, that, you know, legislators from rural areas were coming to us and being like, look, we're hearing a lot from our constituents and business owners that they have a lot of jobs open. Can you just look at the data and tell us, like, is this a new thing? Are vacancies growing? Is it across the state or certain areas, particular industries, types of positions? Are wages increasing? You know, they had all these questions about it. And the data existed, but nobody kind of put it through a rural lens to kind of be like, okay, this is how job vacancies might be different historically and now compared to metropolitan areas. And so when we started looking into this data and I started interviewing folks on the ground in the workforce development organizations, it became pretty clear to me that this was a pretty significant issue. And so I actually, we didn't release just one report on job vacancies. We released four reports on job vacancies. And yes. So we'll kind of dig into those. But, the first part really kind of started with, okay, what do the numbers look like? And let me just highlight kind of a brief couple things when we look at job vacancies. So yeah. I think maybe not anymore, but when we first started looking into this, a lot of conversation, a lot of articles and things were focused on the explosive job growth in the Twin Cities, you know, kind of metropolitan area. But you didn't hear a whole lot about rural areas, even though everybody knew it existed, there wasn't a lot of focus on it. So when we dug into the numbers, we did a couple things. One, just looking at, okay, well, what is the average number of job vacancies annually in the different planning regions across the state? So when we look at just the how much job vacancies have increased, and we have data, I should say, Deed does twice a year they survey businesses across the state to put numbers together to figure out how many job vacancies there are. And they did this starting in 2005. And so when we go back to then and we compare how many average job vacancies there are in 2018, because that's the latest data, compared to 2005, across the state, regions have about 150% more job vacancies today than they did in 2005, which is quite a few years before the Great Recession. So there were a lot of job vacancies back in 2005 as well. That just kind of gives you the extent of that growth. But what's even more interesting is you want to know about job vacancy, the pressure to fill these job vacancies. How hard is it to fill these? And for that, we actually use something called the vacancy rate, which actually uses those average number of job vacancies as a percentage of the total jobs filled in that region. So obviously, the higher the percentage of the job vacancies that make up of the jobs that are filled, the more pressure there is to fill those. And sure. When we actually break down those numbers, every region outside of the metropolitan county is above the metropolitan counties as far as vacancy rate, meaning that to fill job vacancies, the pressure to fill them is actually highest in greater Minnesota. And I refer to greater Minnesota as, you know, areas outside of the seven county metro. They're highest there compared to the seven county metro, which was a little bit even surprising to me. I knew they were high, but I didn't realize they were that high.
When you did the research, did you see any strategies that folks are using to try and fill the vacancies that were either successful or pretty innovative in your eyes?
Yeah, so there's some really interesting things happening across the state. And this was the really, in my mind, so the other three parts of our research really focused on these strategies, and they were a lot of fun. I interviewed just a ton of people that in the workforce development organizations and educational institutions trying to get a handle on what are these strategies, because we wanted to try and identify what are some of the policy barriers that folks are having in implementing these strategies to make them successful. So when we think about strategies to fill this gap, this gap of job vacancies and getting more people, it really falls into two pools. So one is recruiting and retaining labor force. You want to recruit new people into your region, and you want to retain the folks you have, which might be your high school students. And then the second piece is also engaging populations. So engaging your own constituents or your own people that maybe aren't participating in the labor force at high rates.
What were some of the issues that you discovered were being discussed around these two different pots, whether it be recruitment and retention or utilization of current constituents?
You know, when I look at these people recruitment, you know, I think people understood, you know, legislators understood what I was talking about, but they didn't realize the extent to how many folks are involved in doing this, how many organizations, and also some of the barriers in barriers and purpose of what these initiatives were doing. So, you know, I really had to lay out with the people recruitment stuff that, you know, this is based on, you know, University of Minnesota Extension, Ben Winchester's kind of, you know, his whole brain game, the in-migration of 30 to 49-year-olds coming into our regions. And he was kind of one that spearheaded this whole conversation of, you know, what if we actually took advantage of this trend of this 30 to 49-year-olds that in-migrate, that migrate into our rural counties, take advantage of that and try to expand on it and grow that trend instead of worrying so much about the people we're losing. And so these initiatives take advantage of that. And, you know, when you look at why migrating to rural areas, there were four things that popped up: affordable housing, small class sizes, quality of life. And then jobs didn't come particularly high when migrating to rural areas, except for immigrant and refugee populations. When I did my interviews out in rural areas, organizations that were dedicated towards, you know, recruiting, retaining, and helping immigrant and refugee populations try and get a handle on moving into a region and feeling comfortable, you know, they said their number one reasons for moving there was jobs, for the most part.
Sure.
One thing that I thought was really interesting in the research reports that you did was that you talk about being at the end of the slack of our workforce because our labor market is just really tight right now. And you use that as a way to discuss the large groups of individuals or constituents, as you said, that have a lot of skills but maybe haven't been looked to in the past for work. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that's interesting is a lot of folks talk about our low unemployment rate. You know, our unemployment rate is between 2% and 4%, depending on what county you're in right now.
Right.
And that, so when we talk about reaching the end of the slack in the workforce, it's really kind of that we look at unemployment. So then you got to look at, so unemployment only takes a percentage of folks that are participating in the labor force. So there's a whole chunk of people, but it's not a huge chunk of people, but there's a percentage of folks that aren't participating at all. So aren't included in that, in those unemployment numbers. And a lot of businesses and workforce development organizations are looking at these folks. And this is, you know, the types of folks that we're talking about are maybe people with disabilities, people with criminal background history, particularly ex-felons. Immigrant and refugee populations actually have some high barriers to employment. And then what I kind of call folks with just life circumstances, this could be, you know, poverty, single mothers, folks that just, you know, life makes it more, just for whatever reason, they have circumstances in their life that makes it a little bit harder for them to, you know, to apply for a job or to show up to work on time and things like that and follow any sort of rules that might be in place. And so when we talk about barriers, you know, one thing I have found really important to say is that, you know, sometimes this narrative really tries to blame people for not participating in the labor force, but we need to actually recognize that there are business side and population side barriers. And by business side, I mean businesses concerned about hiring these folks. And so it could be concern over costs. If you're hiring somebody with disabilities, what kind of capital investments do I need to make in my facilities to make everything accessible? Fear of legal liability for hiring some of these people that, you know, you have to make certain arrangements so that they can be efficient and productive. And if you don't do that, are they going to get sued? And they're not, but businesses are concerned about this.
Sure.
Lack of awareness. So if you're hiring somebody that, say, is hard of hearing or has hearing difficulties, that there are services available of the state to help make amends and figure out how that person can work in your company. But, you know, businesses don't know about that. And so they're afraid to even approach a person like that to hire. Also, cultural preparedness. We heard this a lot when trying to hire immigrant and refugee populations. You know, businesses, HR departments scared that maybe their current employees aren't ready for such a sudden shift in culture. You know, do they maybe have employees that aren't going to be accepting of new cultures coming in? Do they have managers that speak Spanish? Do they have people there or the equipment necessary that can communicate safety warnings and things like that in different languages? And also there's just, you know, HR folks and business owners that have negative perceptions. So, you know, a lot of folks, if you talk to a business, they're going to say, oh, ex-felon means bad worker, right? And
sure,
that's not the case, but that's the barrier that exists for these people. And then on the population side, you know, there's everything from healthcare issues to transportation to having childcare, to just flat out poverty, not, you know, not being able to just get in participating. And so, You know, it was interesting hearing about all of this and hearing these barriers being identified and the amount of work that's going into engaging these populations by our workforce development organizations and businesses. You know, businesses deserve some credit for the, there's some in Minnesota that are really cutting edge in engaging these folks. And, you know, one of the things I keep telling legislators is workforce development has changed. So it's no longer just about job training. You know, if there's a mass layoff, usually our workforce development organizations go out, assess that labor pool that's getting laid off, figure out what their skills are and try and connect them with new jobs. Well, now the whole thing is not just about job training and assessment, but if when you're dealing with folks with this many barriers, you're talking about educating businesses, you're talking about connecting up with health services, human services, you're dealing with social workers, you might be helping businesses understand that they're going to be dealing with, a parole officer and other sorts of meetings that an ex-felon might have to go to and might not be able to make work for certain hours. You're talking about housing and housing stability, and you're talking about transportation. So our workforce development organizations, our businesses, are having to reach out to a much broader network to engage these populations than I think they're used to. And so that's been really interesting, and it also pulls in another whole lot of questions about funding and policy and things like that. So yeah, that was a really interesting piece.
And those population or community barriers are often the hardest, especially for those who have a past involvement with the criminal justice system.
Yeah, that was probably one of the biggest barriers for these folks is just general misunderstanding and just lack of willingness to try and work with that particular population. And talking to the Department of Corrections, they have one person that's helping the parole officers and helps these individuals being released from prison, helping them find jobs. But also housing stability was a big thing for these folks.
Sure.
Just coming out of prison, they may not have a place to stay. And you can imagine trying to go into a community that's a little bit small, a little bit more rural, trying to find a place. One, just trying to find a place to rent, because that's hard right now just for anyone. Mm-hmm. But then two, trying to find a landlord willing to rent to you would be really, really hard. And so that's something that they're really struggling with.
In the early 2000s, I worked in vocational rehabilitation, and it was a real challenge to get anyone to want to meet with us to talk about our clients, whether it was somebody who had a disability or an individual with a criminal history, or even just somebody who didn't have the perfect job history in itself. So it's really exciting to hear that there's this shift.
Well, what was interesting is some of the parole officers were making comments that, you know, back in the 2000s, they had to beg employers to even listen to them about hiring maybe a client that they had that just released from prison. And now they have businesses calling them to figure out how they can connect to folks that are just being released from prison. And so the tide is shifting. The narrative is shifting in a really good way. But they kind of what also made statements about not being completely prepared for this shift as well. I mean, how could you be? So it was a pretty quick shift from the Great Recession to today. So,
and I think that one thing that kind of shows a similarity with workforce is that in the 2000s, it didn't matter if you were urban or rural, you were still finding it hard to get someone to talk to you about some of those different population groups. And so it was maybe just that in the urban areas, you had more people telling you no, as compared to some of the rural communities. So it's great to see that there is this, like you said, shift in the narrative.
What differences do you see in some of those issues that you spoke about that you were seeing in rural Minnesota? How do you think that plays out in the 7-county metro area? Do you see any of those pressures being the same or being handled a bit easier?
Yeah, just by sheer resources available to folks in 7-county metro, just because of population density and I would argue funding availability, there's just a lot more organizations engaging with these populations to help kind of make these connections. You know, out in greater Minnesota, we have the workforce development boards engaging these populations, helping businesses connect to these populations and doing workforce development in general. And we also have DEED across the state that works alongside them as well and does some of this work. But for the most part, you know, outside of the workforce development and DEED and our CAP agencies, there aren't these kind of standalone individual workforce development organizations like they have in the Twin Cities. The Twin Cities has a whole ecosystem of workforce development nonprofits that are outside of the workforce development boards and outside of DEED that get grant funding to do very specific things. There's a lot more of them that do this kind of work. And I feel like, you know, as far as having resources for transportation, as far as resources involved with organizations helping do some of this training, making some of these connections, it's just much more rich than it is in Greater Minnesota. So that's one piece. The second piece, I think, one of the big differences, and we talk about this in our report, is that the funding available to our organizations maybe isn't as equitable as it should be, I think, at this point in time.
Right. And I think that one argument that it seems like I hear a lot from people is, well, it makes sense that more money is being allotted to the 7-county metro area because the population is so big there. How would you respond to that argument, I guess?
Yeah, I would say it's a valid argument. And even taking that into account, it was still unequal.
Okay.
So if we were to look, let me pull up an example here. So let's say, let's take that state grant and direct appropriations money. Let's take that for an example. If we actually put it out, so funding per 18 to 64 year old adult, right? So that's the population we're using, funding per 18 to 64 year old. That state funding in the Twin Cities, it was $9.65 per 18 to 64 year old that went to 7-county metro organizations. That was way higher than nearly across the state. For example, in central Minnesota, it was $1.19 per 18 to 64 year old. In Northwest,
gosh,
it was $5.53. Northeast, it was $4.47. Yeah, there was a big difference. The only region
Those
that did, they're
huge.
The only region that did comparative to the metro was actually Southwest Minnesota, interestingly enough, at $9.51. So just about 10 cents less than the metro county. But the only reason they were able to do so good is because they were one of the pilot programs, one of the initial pilot programs that started up this competitive grant program. And so they were kind of already in the mix of, as far as like, they were the ones that kind of helped start it. And so they just kind of get the money every year now because they're really good at it.
Sure.
And they do good work, but the rest of the organizations really, really struggle to get to be eligible for this funding. So yeah, it was a huge difference. $9.65 compared to, like I said, $1 to $5, $4. Yeah.
That
so even
is really
taking
surprising.
That into account. Yeah, we were kind of surprised too.
You know, one group of people that we really haven't touched on yet is high school students, our future workforce.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you learned as you talked to people about how they're engaging high school students, not only in maybe getting them into jobs in their local communities, but also just training them so that they're ready for the next step.
Yeah, so this is another report where I was really surprised by what I was able to find out. So there's a lot going on in rural areas trying to engage high school students on essentially their opportunities that are available to them in their local region, either after high school or maybe even after they graduate college, planting the seed that they can come back and find good opportunities. One interesting piece, so Luke Greiner from DEED, he's the labor force analyst. So he actually did a really cool survey. So he went down to these big career expos down in Southwest Minnesota. One was in Marshall, one was in Worthington. And he kind of gives like a big talk show presentation to all the students there. They kind of cycle through in groups of 50 or 60 or whatever, asking them questions about what they're interested in, what fields, here's some of the money they could make, things like that. But he does a quick survey. And one of the questions he asked, and they all respond using their cell phones. And one of the questions he asked was, he asked these 10th graders, do you think you could get a good paying job in the career cluster of your choice in this region? 75% of the students said yes. And I was really surprised by that. I always had this picture in my head that rural students were leaving because they thought they had to or because they figured they couldn't find a good job. But that wasn't the case with this. And so it really got me thinking about, man, what are all the ways in which we're engaging students? And let me tell you, it's a lot. So obviously you have these job expos, these regional job fairs that bring together businesses to highlight you know, their jobs that are available to these students, not only like right now as a high school student, but as a career after high school, or even trying to convince them to maybe go to a two-year technical college to come back and work some of these jobs, but also the apprenticeships that are going on between high school students and businesses, actually having them work in the business, do some being hands-on, a lot of internships. And then the big thing was career and technical instruction. So when I was going to high school, it was during a time when testing was all the rage and all the community, all the career and technical education programs went away. So things like mechanics, shops, all that stuff, just mm-hmm. when I was going through, no longer existed. Well, now you're seeing this huge resurgence in school yes. programs redeveloping these things. And it's really, really interesting. One that I always like to point out because I think it's kind of cool. So up in Brainerd, big resort area, a lot of lakes, a lot of folks go up there. All the resorts got together and they invited the superintendents of the school districts in the region, the mayors, some city council members, county commissioners, and a whole bunch of kind of leaders in that region. They had them over to one of the resorts and they cooked for them, 5-course meal. And then they gave this presentation about how much they need cooks and chefs and line cooks, or, you know, whatever they're all called. And even like restaurant managers, communications people, like they're in dire need of these folks, and that they wanted to help start and fund something called ProStart programs, which is part of the National Restaurant Association Educational Foundation. They start this whole curriculum that high school students can be involved in to learn about the culinary arts, all the way from learning how to be a chef to also managing a restaurant and communications and social media and stuff. And so the restaurants pitched in a bunch of money, they did some fundraising, and they helped install commercial kitchens in a bunch of high schools up there. And they have this ProStart program going on where high school students can participate and actually take classes on the culinary arts. And it's so far been a huge success. And they've had interns going in and out of their restaurants now. And it's just a really cool thing. It's actually something I wish I would have had when I was going to high school.
Yes.
Because that would have been really, really cool.
Well, so, and anyway. I think that just kind of that focus too on there are things that you can learn and implement right away.
Right, right. And another one too. So Lyft, they're out of Southwest Minnesota. It's Lyft Career Pathways. They're an organization that provides grants and then helps provide some services to help school districts in Southwest Minnesota collaborate with businesses on developing curriculums and programs that are based on kind of jobs and job needs in the region. So around nursing, there's also stuff about like working on planes and jets and things like that. All kinds of really cool programs. I think they're getting close to 60 programs now. If I think I have the last right, or maybe it was 30. I can't remember, but across Southwest Minnesota, a lot of really interesting, cool programs happening. Now, one thing that's really interesting that I keep telling legislators, the suburbs of the Twin Cities metropolitan area that looks at rural areas as obviously no opportunities, but is able to make that connection and learn about some of these rural areas, mm-hmm. maybe has always wanted to live there, but figured they couldn't find a job. Boy, that's pretty cool.
Absolutely. And so, you know, there are these shifts happening in rural Minnesota around training programs and that type of thing. Again, putting on that metro hat for just a few minutes, what do you mm-hmm. see as kind of similarities there? Are there training programs for high school students to engage them in positions the same way that we're seeing in rural Minnesota?
I think so. You know, that's a really good question. When I first started doing this research, there was this kind of conversation around, it seems like the metropolitan students had a lot more access to career opportunities and things like that, just because of the natural ecosystem that's there. Again, kind of going back to all the organizations and nonprofits that already exist in the Twin Cities metropolitan area that kind of do this work. They're also doing some of this work in high schools. So not just engaging populations that have high barriers to employment, but also engaging with businesses and high school students and trying to make those connections. And that was not so relevant in high schools across rural areas, you know, up to 5-10 years ago when testing became such a big thing. And a lot of rural school districts have such tight budgets mm-hmm. that it needs to be acknowledged that offering these types of programs cost money. And the only way they're able to offer these programs are through funding and grants through Lyft in Southwest Minnesota. I talked to numerous superintendents and program directors that are collaborating on these programs that said, if it wasn't for Lyft and the grant money, I don't know if we could do this because it costs money to offer these, because you have school districts collaborating. Well, this one school district has to send those students and transport those students to another high school because they can't all offer the same program. They have to collaborate and come together at a central spot to do this. And so there's transportation costs that are pretty big. Another key piece that's worth mentioning is that the metropolitan areas have a lot more access to teachers that can teach these programs. So one interesting wrinkle when doing these career and technical education programs is that you still have to have a state secondary instructor's license. Well, somebody that's going to teach, let's say, nursing is probably going to be somebody that's already a professional in the field and probably doesn't have the secondary instructor's license. They're just not sitting around. There's a lot more of those you'll see in the Twin Cities. Okay. So in a rural area, they'll have to approach the local career and technical colleges and some of their faculty. Well, guess what? The faculty don't have secondary instructor's licensure. They're faculty of a college. They've never thought about having the need to have that licensure. And so they can. So these programs will then hire the faculty. But then since that teacher doesn't have a license, a secondary instructor's license, they then fail to get Perkins funding for the program. So they lose out on money.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I'm just like, oh, are you kidding me?
Let's just add more hurdles for people to have to get over.
Yeah, I know. And it's things, like I said, there's always good intentions and these things aren't, you know, barriers put up for a reason, you know, to keep people out. It's just conversations need to be had to figure out how can we tweak some of this stuff to make it work better. So I think transportation funding and the teacher piece are the two main differences between in implementing some of these programs compared to in the metropolitan area.
So as we think about workforce, what is one thing that you feel rural Minnesotans should understand about the urban workforce and challenges or issues they might be facing?
Okay. Let's see. Well, I would say that, and this sounds bad, but I don't mean it to be, that in metropolitan areas, the competition of the younger population is an interesting element that we probably don't feel in rural areas. You just have so much more access to talent and young people to work in positions that I think sometimes working in some of these organizations, maybe being a bit older in the Twin Cities, can feel a bit of pressure from the younger people coming up. And I hear about that in kind of culture. The culture changes is a lot faster. And so keeping up with that is kind of an interesting element. And I think there's a lot more of those types of issues than we would probably see in a rural area.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of that. So that's a really good reflection to make there. And so then on the flip side, what is one thing that you feel urban Minnesotans should understand about the rural workforce and challenges or issues that we're facing out here?
Yeah, well, I think just the main theme is that there are a ton of opportunities out here, and those opportunities aren't just low wage, low skilled jobs. And I'm using air quotes, which you obviously can't see.
We can all imagine.
Yeah. It's worth noting that the wages for job vacancies in Greater Minnesota have increased significantly more than they have in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And so even though the pay is still a little bit lower in Greater Minnesota, the increases have been highest. And so the gap that used to be between Twin Cities and rural Minnesota and median wage jobs for job vacancies has closed considerably. So businesses have been doing their job at increasing wages, one, but also I will argue too that passing the minimum wage policy made a difference too in rural Minnesota, and we need to be very happy for that policy because it made a pretty big impact in rural Minnesota wages as well. But you know, the big thing is that there's a lot of opportunity out here, a lot of good opportunity. And, you know, for urban folks that maybe are looking for a change of pace, you can find it out here and make a good living. And if you got skills, bring them.
Perfectly said, Kelly. Perfectly said. Thank you so much for the research that you've done, Kelly, and for coming on the podcast to talk about it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you to Kelly Ash with the Center for Rural Policy Development for joining us today for our great conversation. You can learn more about Kelly and his colleagues' work by visiting their website at www.ruralmn.org. Visit the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality webpage at extension.umn.edu/community-development, where you will find resources on Ben Winchester's brain gain work that Kelly referenced, as well as many other great resources for your community. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date on new research and resources for communities and those who lead them. We hope that you will join us again for another episode of Vital Connections on Air.